Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
And I'm Tom Castura.
In this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. So let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 9th, 2026. What do you got for us, Tom?
So I got an article from socket.dev. It's titled Malicious DiDEX Packages Published to NPM and PyPI After Maintainer Compromise. So kind of going into something that, you have your single character executables. I can't stop looking at the supply chain type stuff, especially targeted to developers. I think it's a very interesting category, but these keep flashing across my all my checks for Intel. So definitely want to talk about this next one. So researchers at socket.dev discovered malicious packages targeting the DiDEX ecosystem, or DYDX ecosystem, published to both NPM and PyPI. It's illustrating how attackers weaponize those trusted package names to lure developers into those supply chain compromises, a repeated activity that we're continuously seeing. The bad actors registered package names that closely mimic legitimate DiDEX client libraries and related tooling, tricking users into consuming malware when they imported or installed these dependencies. Unlike the instances we've talked about in that were like this before, where typo squatting was kind of involved, this campaign used names with plausible semantics, you know, really making detection with like simple string matching a lot harder, increasing the likelihood of accidental installs as well. The incident really reinforces that developer consumable packages, not just production images, but they're valid and effective attack surface for supply chain compromise. So the malicious packages were created on both NPM and PyPI. The names resembled legitimate DiDEX libraries, you know, really looking, they were names that just differed slightly by just the punctuation or order of the version numbers, things like that. They were designed to be pulled automatically too by the dependency resolution or the CI pipelines of those environments, which actually makes it a little scary in my opinion. These malicious packages include plausible descriptions, plausible versioning, README content to hide their kind of true intent, and really blend into that developer workflow. So a lot of focus on trying to accomplish that. The packages contain code that, once installed, executed malicious logic, which gave way to location-based execution, unauthorized network calls to attacker domains, credential theft, environmental data exfil to remote C2 instances, and the ability to install full RAT in system control. Because modern projects often really trust and automatically install packages from NPM and PyPI, especially those pulled indirectly through like transitive dependencies, this campaign could penetrate environments without direct user intents, which is kind of one of the key points I pulled from this article, Scott. The publication on both major public registries, so both NPM and PyPI, really indicates that the adversary had a broader view of that, of the multi-language ecosystems and the broader use of the environments, and sought to, you know, really maximize that impact across JavaScript and Python developer communities. So nothing necessarily at all novel here. For me, I just really wanted to bring this one up, short and simple one, to say, you know, this is continuing to happen. There's always these evolutions. Seeing how some of these systems work and leverage these packages are both interesting to me, Scott, and scary, because I didn't fully know the landscape of these environments because we don't live in them, right? But seeing all the attacks and the focuses on this, you know, it's initially thinking that it was something somebody had to be tricked into pulling down or installing. But when you see these different environments that are out here that are leveraging these kind of these content staging areas, these packages that are pulled in automatically by their systems, the adversaries are smart in what they're looking to set up here. I think there's some sophistication and real true understanding of how these environments work, how they will pull packages, and they're staging themselves right in those pipelines. It's very interesting to me. So I'm just curious what you think.
Yeah, I like how this provides some of what the, I guess, motivation or goal is for this, you know, with the either the fingerprinting, the more credential theft, and then there's the remote access piece. So you can kind of give an idea. I mean, it sounds like the attacks that kind of come across a lot of times have it's obfuscated code. So this is it unobfuscated, so you won't potentially be able to use, you know, maybe the exact code base to try to make signatures or search through code, if there's obfuscation going on. But there's a couple things in the code that kind of call out that I would say are more low-hanging fruit things. Like, for instance, when they talked about the remote access Trojan and how it operates, you know, it's nice to look to see that it's got pretty much a static beacon timer associated with it, where if it has something to execute, it only sleeps for 5 seconds. If there's nothing that's passed, then it beacons every 10 seconds. So if you just have any kind of network telemetry visibility or even proxy, because it's going to a proxy website looking for like an egregious amount of hits and then figuring out what those intervals are, or if you have logic where you can wrap intervals around hits that just continue. Now there could be code, you know, in some other place that kind of like makes that sleep or turn off for a period or whatever, but that's always a really good thing to kind of look for, are static beacons. And there's a lot of tools that are pretty good at identifying that if you have, you know, some of those more advanced security suite of things, but sometimes you don't know if you don't look, right? So there was that piece that kind of stood out to me. There's also, they mentioned there's a couple, the inclusions of files. So like the Bootstrap Pi or the config dot Pi, the Bootstrap helping with persistence for some things. It's not uncommon for extra files to be pulled down, but it is worth noting what files potentially get installed with the package, because typically most repos is pretty much like the wheel or the run code. So you, unless you're like downloading the full repo, like you would, you know, you think of GitHub and you download everything versus just what you need to run something, then you typically won't have a lot of extra stuff, or you'd have stuff that, you know, you should look at, I guess, the extra files to see what's in those, to see if they make sense. And they're heavily obfuscated. It's very questionable too. Something else to kind of pay attention to. And then, you know, when we think about these types of attacks, you know, it's really bad when a developer gets their credentials taken and then they legitimate packages can be augmented. So I feel like there's a level of ownership that kind of has to fall on these repo holders or whatever, with some sort of conditional access. Yeah, I think it's very easy for those types of controls to be implemented. Like, it's just seen from the same IP, same geographic, relative to the same time. And, you know, conditional access isn't about like necessarily blocking or allowing. It's more about, hey, is this consistent with previous access? And if it's not, ask for more verification, right? And then, you know, even requiring 2FA, I think that should just be a standard, because if people are going to develop for others, you know, I think that should just be a more of a standard, that you're basically putting other people at risk. And, you know, it's like, you know, owning a car or owning a firearm or whatever, there might, you know, obviously be more requirements around what you need to have, because what you do with those things can be impactful to others. So a similar mindset. And then the other attack that I never really thought about, but something that we probably should pay attention to, is you kind of touched on it, but, you know, sometimes like maybe I develop a package and it's not necessarily typo squatted or whatever you want to call it, adjacent to a legitimate package, or I don't take over the full package, but that dependency section. So, you know, I've seen where some Python packages, for instance, will do a quick check to see if those dependencies exist. And if they don't, they automatically pull them down. Well, I think that would be a really clever way to have some packages completely you can almost name it whatever you want, so it sounds legit, and people won't necessarily look for it because it's maybe not something that would be of any value, but would make sense as a dependency or a library, so that if you can take over someone else's repo and just add your package as a dependency and a way to check dependencies and then auto install those dependencies, then yeah, no one would be the wiser, right? That they're using some code that actually isn't approved. I don't know if that is really audited so much, unless someone's adding something, because they're developing further in the code. So that would be, I think, another clever way to drop packages, unbeknownst to the developer using them, or the people running the code when it updates, for instance. But yeah, those are kind of my few cents on the topic.
Yeah, all good points. The dependency piece actually gave me a little bit of hives thinking about the potential from that. But yeah, no, I mean, it's great points. This is something I think keep your eye on it. Anybody that's listening out here, you're going to continuously hear me because I can't help but keep falling across these, and I think it's very important. But you also mentioned that one part too about considering the beaconing piece, right? I know we've talked about use case scenarios in the past, Scott, about this and like ways to leverage the data to find those beaconing pieces. I think there's even a way to filter in considering what we're talking about. So use case specific around like developer type machines, developer accounts and systems. I think if you narrowed in on that, even with lesser tooling to be able to identify those things, I think you could still probably get a pretty good weight in gold bears as far as telemetry, you know what I mean? If you just kind of narrow in on the developer machines that this might take place on as a start.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when people talk supply chain, I know software is a thing, but they're thinking like software suites a lot of times when this conversation was coming out. And even in the earlier stages, it was like, well, where's the hardware device coming from? Can we trust the location? Does it go pass through certain areas that we don't trust, meaning we lose potential control? And that was the supply chain a lot of people worried about. The open source developer code space is, I think, a greater supply chain risk because it can be a moving target versus the other ones can be very, very impactful. But once discovered, they're kind of, there's nothing else they could do to it, like do something adjacent. They have to start all over with a new attack.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And who knows how many seeds, how many things have been placed in a lot of these. I mean, calling back to just like, it's not necessarily a direct supply chain type. It's not like really a supply chain type relative to this, but like Log4j's example, like cleaning that stuff out and identifying where it actually took, where you were actually vulnerable was a pain because it was, dependencies. It was libraries stacked inside of other programs. It was open source stuff that just carried it with it. That's the realm. This isn't just some community sitting off in a corner just doing open source stuff. A lot of this stuff is going to find its way into common everyday processes and systems. So I agree with you. This one's bigger, more scarier when it comes to supply chain. It's not your typical, like SolarWinds type of attack type thing. There's a lot more possibility here, which often leads to a lot more compromise.
And a much harder problem to solve in some ways, right?
Very much so. Yeah. It takes a lot of detailed dedication to really kind of iron out processes for this one. And I don't know that anyone's got a good grasp on it yet, at least not that I've seen.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, what's next?
All right. So the next one I thought was just good because, sometimes we like to frame, how do you predict what kind of attacks are coming? And so this is just a basic kind of news article, but it's from HelpNet Security. And it's titled State-Backed Phishing Attacks Targeting Military Officials and Journalists on Signal. And so this was reported by German security authorities, basically saying they're seeing state-backed hacking groups engaging in attempts to just phish senior political figures, military officials, diplomats, investigative journalists, across Germany and Europe utilizing Signal. And why I bring this up is because, we had all the stuff, Signal stuff hit the news and how government officials are using Signal and all sorts of stuff. And, you had two different sides that came out of that. You had the one side saying, we shouldn't use Signal because it's not approved or whatever, right? And then you had the other side saying, but it's secure. Everybody's using it. Why shouldn't we use it? Whatever. But either way, from an attacker perspective, what they're going to hear is, okay, so there are systems that are harder to break into potentially because the way they're managed, governed, or controlled. There's a third party type tool that people potentially communicate sensitive things over because it has security controls. What is the most likely target or susceptible target and one that we can actively develop against or test against, right? And so Signal kind of wins out on that. And what's interesting, the two different approaches they had, one was they basically reached out to these officials on Signal, which is easy to do because Signal's tied to phone numbers, right? That's how you can kind of like set up who you can talk to on Signal. That's how you can find people too. So if you're able to find that information, which I'm sure big officials, you probably could find some way, they would send them a like Signal support talking about there's, some security type issues, suspicious activity, and then told them they, and the target told was providing a security PIN or a one-time verification code. But either way, when the victims were to comply, what it would allow the attackers could then register an account on a device they control and effectively take over their account based on the back and forth and providing PINs for things. So that was the first one. The second variant of this attack was basically attackers tried to convince the target to scan a QR code, for whatever legitimate reason there. And in reality, that code links an additional device to the victim's account. So it's basically like the authorization. So sometimes we see that, I believe Steam is a gaming platform. And there's a few others, right, where they try to use the app and to make it easy to log into things. You scan a QR on whatever device you're trying to log into, and then that authorization happens on the back end. I'm assuming Signal's the same way, trying to add a device, then try to make it easy where if you want to add a device, instead of going through the process, you can scan a QR code, and then now that device is tied to that account, and you can use it as such. And the thing is by doing that, they also could read all the messages and monitor conversations without immediately locking any of the users out. So it's just a way to basically add devices to these other users' profiles. And, my only guess is you might have to have a separate device per target, but I don't know if that's even true necessarily, because I just assume that would look weird from a Signal side if you have one device attached to multiple profiles. But it just shows from a like security context, why learning about Signal made Signal a problem. So maybe before the conversations on whether it was right or wrong, wasn't as catastrophic as now we know that's what's being utilized. And it's a third party public facing, application that can be profiled. Figure out all these loopholes, figure out how that adding device works, figure out all these things, and then try to construct phishing around it or construct potential security weaknesses. But, like typical things, if there's not a great technical weakness, there is a human weakness. And how do you take advantage of that and still gain access to the same things that you think the technical security controls are protecting? So it's just a really interesting concept, like I said, and I always like to think, when big events happen and there's known target sets in those big events, especially involving technology, how does that drive the attacker and nation state driven community? And it's just a good example of that. I mean, it's taken some time, right? Within a year at least, or a little less than a year from, when we were talking all the Signal stuff in the US. But yeah, that kind of gives you a time frame and expectations in some ways. So thought it was a good thing just to highlight. What were your thoughts?
I think you hit a nail on the head with the human piece. This one goes to that, trying to understand the psychology. When people use a platform like Signal, especially when you talk, and as we've seen, as you mentioned with stuff that happened in the US, when you see folks that are using Signal, typically it's for very specific conversations that they want to have, really towards more of a private ID, encrypted, private, and then the whole idea of Signal. At least I would think that. So to think that you wouldn't also have the similar scrutiny that I think most of us that have any digital access to email, using text message and things like that, understanding the basic phishing types approaches. It just goes to show you that even though we abundantly know what this is, it still works, and they can still target. And they can target anything, and the phishing just always finds a way to work. And it doesn't matter what platform you're in. And once they profile it, like you said, it's easy to go after. It just surprises me though, how much we already know has been leveraged in this specific app, right? Or in this idea, because you would think that there would be more scrutiny to this, but we've seen with plenty of evidence that the users are still users, right? And they're still human, and they still do this. They still make the mistakes. So that's one of the things that's easy to. Yeah.
It's just like a wrap of just because something is secure, you just got to also take into consideration what it is you're securing. If you just want the privacy and the utmost protection for conversations, and the conversations are around your own privacy or a group of people's privacy or whatever, And that can make sense, but when the risk or the level of content starts to grow out of that, where you're kind of accountable for things that aren't you or the group you're specifically with, and it can, you know, unintentionally have impacts on others that aren't involved in the same communication, that's when you start thinking about, am I using the right platform, right? Because you're making decisions on behalf of other people. And I think that should raise that bar a little bit. But one thing that was mentioned, you know, I mentioned the two different variants. One was like trying to get the pin approach. If they leverage that, you would actually know they took over your account, because it basically unregisters your account and registers their device. So you kind of get alerted. So they have access to basically everything going backwards. But the QR one is, they basically have now added it. They're like an added device instead of a takeover. So the only way you can see there's more devices on your account, you can actually go to settings and link devices under the Signal app, and you can see how many devices are linked. So, you know, for someone who's security cognizant and they use Signal and they like Signal, it's worth, you know, keeping an eye on that from time to time. Or if something wonky, you know, happens, you have a weird communication or something, that's a good next step, right? To go verify and go look. And if you find something, then it's worth noting, potentially sharing, communicating that to the right channels.
Yeah, very much.
But yeah, what do you have next?
All right. So next from my side, I got an article from Talos Intelligence. It's titled "Knife Cutting the Edge, Disclosing a China Nexus Gateway Monitoring Adversary in the Middle Framework." Cisco Talos uncovered a long-running, sophisticated Linux-based gateway monitoring adversary in the middle framework, dubbed DKNIFE. It's been active since at least 2019, and it's still being observed in 2026 already. The framework is designed to hijack and manipulate traffic on compromised edge devices, including routers and IoT appliances, to conduct deep packet inspection, credential harvesting, and malware distribution. DKNIFE's operational focus includes disrupting legitimate updates and redirecting victims to malicious content, effectively abusing the traffic path as a stealthy infection vector and a C2 channel. Talos assesses that this infrastructure is operated by a China Nexus actor with code references, configuration language, and targeting patterns consistent with prior China-linked campaigns. So a little bit more about this. DKNIFE is fully featured gateway monitoring and adversary-in-the-middle framework that's comprised of at least 7 Linux-based implants that work together to intercept and manipulate network traffic on compromised gateway and edge devices. The implants perform deep packet inspection. They'll do DNS hijacking and traffic redirection, basically enabling the actor to replace legitimate responses with malicious content. Like as an example, from a mobile device, being able to hijack an Android application update and redirect or add an additional downloads that would be hijacked by the actor to kind of push payloads to victims, as one example. By intercepting traffic, DKNIFE can serve phishing pages up as well, or collect credentials for targeted devices, especially those used by Chinese-speaking users, and also able to intercept messaging, shopping, news activity. You know, you can also build a whole profile. The framework's been observed delivering and coordinating with ShadowPad and Dark Nimbus backdoors, really showing integration with advanced modular malware that's been used in prior China-aligned campaigns. Some of the detailed capabilities also include things like Windows binary hijacking, antivirus disruption, and then that user activity monitoring and profiling. Beyond routers, the framework is capable of impacting PCs, mobile devices, and IoT systems, really just by virtue of its network level manipulation, increasing the potential breadth of compromise. The persistence of C2 infrastructure from 2019 into 2026 really suggests that kind of long-term stealthy operational foothold that we typically see more towards the APT side of the house. And it also kind of suggests that it's almost certainly undetected on many networks. But yeah, some of the things in this, Scott, I just, I found it interesting, a little scary, but basically the way that they're doing this is being able to access some of these devices, and then they leverage various configuration files with hard-coded redirects and passages to go to different things based on what they're targeting and what's being profiled. So as you know, I use one instance with the Android update, they, you know, they basically see that this device is trying to go get this update. They have a hard-coded identifier that will redirect them to somewhere else. They'll pull a fake update down, which becomes a malicious payload, and then they're off to the races. The breadth of this, though, is scary, man. I think this is a pretty creative one. As far as, you know, my point of view is concerned, I think the possibilities of use of this are really broad. But yeah, you know, I'll take a breath. I'm curious what you thought when you read through this one.
Yeah, so, I mean, this one is really interesting because of where they're attacking. It seems like a lot of the attacks are really about hitting edge or devices that traffic potentially flows through. And that's significant for two reasons. One, they don't have to attack further, right? So they can potentially take advantage of exploits much easier. And then the lateral is very different, right? Because you're not going to see that as a beachhead necessarily. Like, for instance, the DNS hijacking is a crazy one where, you know, they basically can use any kind of DNS request going to a specific site you want to go to for phishing. Now you get hit with the phishing instead. Or even like when you're trying to download a file, the fact they had an engine that they would install. I was thinking, it sounds similar to Snort because they're saving things in the .rules file and then deleting it once that's loaded into memory. But the rules were essentially is a file being basically downloaded based on the web request, a .exe. And if it is, send to this other site and pull down this other .exe instead. And so now you're offering up your next payload based on some standard user behavior where they're looking to pull something down and run something. And they're not going to see anything none the wiser. They're just going to get the payload and run it. So to try to trace that, like where did the compromise happen? You're going to think it's just a user-driven behavior or a user-driven phish or whatever, even though there could be a compromise further out on your edge that just has the ability to basically reinfect you and do other things. So very tricky because a lot of times there's not a lot of visibility out past an edge router or those types of things. The other thing that thinking about, only because just recently I was talking with someone that works in the, you know, payment processing industry, is, you know, so, you know, you have these edge routers, right? Potentially. And sometimes that, you know, if you're just a standard user at home, you're not necessarily in a business is potentially getting hit with this. A lot of fraud is committed by these proxying through these edge routers at home networks because they're more trusted or more expected to have the type of transactions coming from there, especially if it's a place that does a lot of online purchasing already anyways, right? Because people work from home and live at home. And so, but he was saying that, you know, what was shown as a problem is this helps with fraud, but then when your service provider learns that they had a vulnerability and there's all these infected whatever devices, you know, their protocol is to basically send a new device and get the other one back. And a lot of times they don't clean up the device they get back. It goes into like a repo of, hey, these are devices that we pulled and now they can sell them at a discount to maybe like countries and stuff they wanted to expand access to. So now they're just redistributing, you know, devices that can act as proxies or do things like this to places unbeknownst to them because there's not a great cleanup process for some of this stuff as well. So only bring that up is just, hey, just because you get a device, sometimes I guess be paranoid, but yeah, it's very innovative. It's, you know, very clear that the good understanding of, kind of the Linux operating system and especially how it goes to managing networking. We've talked about in the past, some interesting persistent, techniques or ways to, you know, manage certain things, the system, you know, in this case, with the DNS stuff, what was it? Config. What was the file? I gotta scroll, but you know, in Windows it's the hostname file, right? If that hostname file gets updated, sometimes you can like hard code, what would typically go to a legit site, but because you hard code the DNS IP address, you can basically force any requests go to a C2 that looks legit and stuff like that. So knowing how DNS could be controlled on the host, knowing how different, like how tunnels can be set up on a host, are really important. I'm gonna blank on the other thing I wanted to, the tool you can set up firewall rules from the command line. I'm already forgetting what that Windows command is, but you can basically set up a tunnel with that where anything comes and hits a port just redirects. So there's all sorts of things that can happen on the OS, on a system, that just help you leverage that system to attack other systems indirectly. That's kind of what I'm getting at. And this is a great example of a lot of different capabilities to do just that. And there's a lot of the whys in there too, because they explain this is what they did, but by doing this, they achieved these things. The biggest thing that stood out to me though, as far as like, what would I look for some of this activity? And this is assuming you have visibility past, if it's an edge router, it could be kind of hard, but I mean, if you do have something outside, it's just looking for direct callouts to IP addresses via HTTP or HTTPS. Always a great indicator for what's going on. Even if you just have one very simple device at the furthest edge, it just looks for that. If you can get that telemetry, it would help in a lot of cases, at least force attackers to stand up legitimate infrastructure with certs. That when certs get created, then you have to burn aliases or burn things in order to get some of that set up. So quite more effort, and potentially can get other things ripped out if they reuse stuff. So, yeah. So just really cool from a technical standpoint.
Yeah, there is, you know, the telemetry thing on the surface seemed like a barrier as I was kind of reading through this one. And, you know, considering the devices that you're generally seeing, but it has a breadth of devices. So I don't think anything's necessarily out of play. I think it's just, you know, opportunity and what's something they can get a foothold on to look at traffic coming through.
I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think the one good thing is it does identify the type of device to look at. Like, it's not like I need to go through my whole network and look for something like this. You know what I mean? Or every host. It's like, hey, if we have a device that functions as this kind of role, we should look at these things. And what's nice here is if you just did a quick look, even if you don't have the telemetry and they're able to take a peek, it gives you ideas of where to look as well. That would be clear indicators, because they're using basically built-in configurations for built-in Linux tools.
Yeah, and that's the key. So that's kind of what I was looking at. There are a couple pieces of low-hanging fruit here that go towards that behavioral identification of certain things. So while this does seem very complex, it's been up for a while. It has it's a pretty big web with a lot of different capabilities in it. One of the things that they did mention in the article was around the DK knife downloader piece. So as it's kind of establishing itself on systems, and again, if you have telemetry to give in systems, but I think just broadly speaking, these behaviors are, like we've talked about in the past, where you see a given APT or a sophisticated attack adversary, they fall back to some common behaviors. So you had kind of mentioned the stuff with like the DNS.conf file, right? A couple other really basic things that you tend to see in Linux when it comes to like one for persistence, like actually a couple of persistence items. They immediately modifies the /etc/rc.local file. It's commonly used to execute commands and scripts after a system boots and initialize the services. This is one you tend to see. Also, the leveraging of once the C2 is established and the binary is set, it'll set itself like as a persistent service, if you will, using the nohup command, nohup. That one's commonly seen to make sure that something that's running will stay running, even if the shell's killed or the system's backed off of it, will continue to be there. So it lives in the background. So there's a couple really basic behaviors that you see adversaries use in Linux that are part of this that might be of benefit. But again, it'll also depend on the telemetry and the devices in your scope. So,
yeah.
All right, Scott, what's the last item on the docket for this week?
So this one I think was interesting because we've talked about some of this stuff before, and this is pretty recent, but it's a blog from Huntress, and it's called "They Got In Through Sonic Wall, Then They Tried to Kill Every Security Tool." And it's just interesting because it does touch on how Windows is designed as far as utilizing drivers, what security controls are around those. They touch on a lot of that, which I think is all very informative and good for people to know, right? And why people kind of take this approach. But essentially, it looked like when they were looking at this breach that happened this February, they saw where someone clearly had credentials to try to get in through the SonicWall VPN. And SonicWall, they even showed there, had the configuration to, if something failed so many times from a certain location, then try it from another. So it's clear that the attacker had the infrastructure, or like the botnet proxy infrastructure, to try to get into the network. And once in, what was interesting is they mentioned that the discovery that was being leveraged was just really aggressive network reconnaissance. And it kind of, to me, sounds similar to what you would see from an in-map. They had tons of ICMP ping sweeps, net BIOS name requests, and SMB targeted activity, including a lot of SYN flood behavior. And they even talk about, like, it was like 370 SYNs per second. And the SYNs effectively is just kind of like determining what ports are open. So like I said, it felt very in-mappy from that perspective. But then what was, the more interesting part of the article is the EDR killer, right? So there is an EDR killer that they kind of leveraged through all this. And they used Encase driver. So Encase, if people aren't familiar with Encase, it's a really strong forensics tool to do forensics on machines. So it's able to obviously gain a lot of access. What's interesting about this driver is its certification has been revoked, right? So, you would think that, that would be, something that you maybe, could get past, or something you can defend against. But what's interesting about, the things that prevent, kernels from loading is kernels load so early that the revocation list doesn't have time to load, because sometimes in that kernel load or the driver loads, like, network stack's not even up. So just because something's revoked on kernel sign stuff, a signature for kernels, that's not something that gets enforced, right? So that's one thing about this. So that's like a limitation, right? And then the other is the gap. So apparently on the block list, there is a date. I'm trying to find the actual date because I lost it. I just had it in front of me. I lost it. But there is a date on which, before a certain date, they just basically say they trust all things that are signed, just for legacy and backwards compatibility, right? And the cert expired January 2010, but was signed previously by a true CA. So basically, this driver's allowed to run. And what this driver basically does, it exposes the IOCTL, which is basically like, gives you control to a lot of different user mode processes, or allows user mode processes to actually control things directly on the kernel. So there's user mode protections that are called like PPLs, Protected Process Lite, that really typically guards a lot of critical system processes. But in this case, because they bypasses that protection, then any user mode process, meaning a process you kick off that able to leverage this, can terminate any process. And that's why they specifically targeted the EDRs. So they have a whole list of EDRs. Here's the date. So it was July 29, 2015. And anything signed before that is basically allowed, starting with Windows 10 version 1607. Having the perfect timestamp for when this was signed, having the right privileges, is basically a driver that's really hard to stop unless you have basically the hash of that driver. The good thing is when something is signed, right, in this case, for that digital signature to be valid, because that's something that it does check for. For kernel loads, it will check to see if it's something is valid and signed, like you can enforce that. But by it being signed, that also means people can't like change or modify, because part of that signature says that this is the code that was originally existed when it was signed, and if it were changed, then the signature wouldn't be valid. That's one of the checks. So once you have the hash, for instance, of this, you can basically put something in there to kind of block this capability. So they drop this file, this driver, into the program's data, and then the path was the OEM firmware. And it is a .sys file. So something that, you know, we've commonly talked about is pay attention to when .sys files are created. Hopefully you have the telemetry for that. But if they're created, one, in a weird location, but if they're also created and you don't know what they are, and it's the only system in your environment that seems to have this, it's worth noting, right? Or you see all of a sudden it starts popping up multiple places, but it kind of spreads out almost like, you know, within a certain area. Worth noting as well. Then also there was, for persistence, there was a service that was created as part of this, and it was the service name was the same name as the driver. The binary path was .sys, so there's that cue, and then the service type was kernel driver, and then the start type was demand start. So looking for new services and seeing the kernel driver as a new service is created, another key thing to potentially look for that can be, you know, I guess, really good interest. The other thing I like is they did show, you know, obviously all the EDRs that are mentioned were obfuscated, and they had to be like decoded, right? I think there's some checks that tools are starting to do to look for those, that list. But what's good here is there's a good example of the vendors and the executables that are associated with those vendors. So I'm not sure from a telemetry perspective, but a lot of people don't look at processes that get terminated, right? Or that's not something that sometimes isn't logged or turned on. In this case, I am curious because you're going through basically an effective valid termination of a process call. I'm assuming that you would see when that process gets terminated, and you would see the log for that process being terminated. So here are some binaries or executables that you can target for maybe that kind of telemetry to say, hey, yeah, if we see that, you know, CrowdStrike or SentinelOne or Carbon Black or Palo Alto, like we see those, that process get killed and we don't see it restart within the time frame, because sometimes they could reset, you know, there's things that can happen. It's worth looking into, if not just from a, hey, we don't have protection anymore, right? But there might be a cause that's worth looking into as well. So they have a great list provided in this article. It's worth noting. And the other cool thing that they did when they created this .sys file to try to make it look more legitimate is they basically read the NTIA DLL, which is a standard system 32 file, and they copied its create time and all of its timestamps associated with that file to the timestamps of the file, the .sys file. So it kind of blends in. So not sure what telemetry you would basically try to tie that to, because it looks like they did it in code. So you're not going to be able to see where they'd use some sort of binary command scheme to do that. But just worth noting of what some of the attempts were to try to hide some of the behavior. So yeah, it was just a really cool example of the bring your own vulnerable driver, why it works. Some of the recommendations that I thought were interesting that I wasn't 100% sure on, but it was very informative, was, I guess there is a block list that Microsoft manages, and I think they only update it like twice a year, but there is a block list that's included for drivers that could potentially be vulnerable that it will block outright, but you have to enable the HVCI or the memory integrity security features for it to basically have this block list and enforce it. But something else that you can also do is, I didn't know this at the time, but Microsoft has the recommended driver block rules that you can do via the WDAC, which is you can basically block vulnerable drivers, and there's a list and you can actually get to it. I was trying to, they had a link, the link was kind of broken there, but when I actually looked for basically the vulnerable driver list and everything like that, it took me to the learn.microsoft area. But you can get it from the Microsoft Download Center. And it pulls down a zip that actually has the policies that you can use and a list of XML and everything. And basically what it would do is it puts, and you can enable app control, and you can basically even get alerts when drivers are trying it. So you can set up an alert mode, and they have examples of what that looks like, that you potentially could identify and block on, which would be another way to get telemetry when people are dropping. Like, even if a vulnerable driver shows up, you know there's something else probably going on. So that might be all you need to identify, you know, whatever it is that's interesting. And there was, I think when I pulled it up and looked at it, over 1,000 different vulnerable drivers and the hashes associated with them. And then they had some things based on saying like, hey, if you use a driver before this version, based on the versioning number, that was another way where it did certain checks. So it's just a really good thing to, I guess, have to be aware of. And you might potentially be able to look at what drivers, if you inventory your own, like we talk about software inventories, you could potentially inventory what drivers that you use internally and do some driver based, versioning, saying, hey, all of our drivers are up to this date. If we see anything before this, or there was a vulnerability, for instance, that happened. So now you can change the rule saying, hey, we got to make sure we have this. That'd be an easy way to identify, well, who's running outdated drivers, or if we see this outdated driver and it's vulnerable and it got dropped for whatever instance, if you just went off just the driver name, you could say, well, that's normal in our environment, but this one's weird because of the versioning. That app control gives you the capability to do that. So I thought that was a really good idea, and I'm glad they mentioned it because I dug into that and learned a lot along the way. So yeah, what were your thoughts?
And that was like incredibly well covered, honestly. all the bullet points I had, you already marked down on them full. I won't repeat what you said. Honestly, I like this one. I like the evolution, the kind of more the EDR killer type stuff. I know it's a hot topic for a lot. I think, you know, the two things that I'm just going to kind of echo just these. I think, you know, looking from what I've seen in this article, identifying those .sys files, you touched on that, in abnormal places. I mean, specifically to this one, looking at it in that program data, OEM, firmware, directory path, you know, might give you some fruit. I also think the service start one, you hit that on the head, but I'm just going to echo it again because it stands out. So if you have the telemetry and you're collecting those window events in your system, I believe they are, what is that? 7045 is the ID.
That sounds right.
Grace, if I miss, but I believe it's event ID 7045, or looks for the service creates, but narrowing in to those service type and start type, I think, are the keys there. So if your telemetry allows it, or your wherever you're collecting logs, it does catch that. That could be a really good indicator of looking for something suspicious, especially as it's referenced here. So that kernel driver as the type and the demand start piece really stood out to me. But other than that, Scott, you covered down on that really well. So great job, man.
Yeah, hopefully there's enough there for people to chew on and hopefully defend better against this, because if you get hit with this and you're not ready for it, you're kind of like defenseless, right, in some ways. And right. So you can find that something is actually going on and try to respond to it. But you're definitely behind the eight ball a little bit because of the nature of just disabling visibility. Like, what do you go off of next if you have no telemetry to move forward?
It's right.
Yeah. So, yeah. Just want to make a mention again for this week. We do have the Hunting for Privilege Escalation Level 2 webinar happening. That'll be on February 11th. From 12 to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Another great get your hands dirty, right? Use real data, walk through some things, see what things look like. Just a good experience we're checking out. But with that, I just want to thank everyone for joining the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast this week. Look forward to syncing back up next week. And that closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of February 9th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.